I have the great honor of having Charlotte Iserbeet, who's been a friend for a number of years. She's interviewed with me before. If there are icons in the Liberty Movement in exposing how education has been subverted over the last couple of centuries, Charlotte is it. And she is really an icon in that movement. She's also, I think, probably the matriarch of the education awareness movement. So with that, and I also have a new friend. Charlotte is actually the one that introduced me to this gentleman. His name is John Klyzik, and John has written a fantastic book called The School World Order, and we're going to be talking about education and technocracy and a lot of things that a lot of people are not aware of, but they sure will be after today. And I love having Charlotte on because she knows so many things about so many people in so many circumstances. I think you're going to enjoy this one, Rooster. I thank you for being a great prelude for me. Well, you're doing a good job, my friend. Thank you. And we will do some connecting the dots for you. Thank you for that. All right. I see that Charlotte and John are both on. John, I guess you go by Jake to your friends, but I'm not quite personal enough with you yet that I want to take that liberty. So I'll call you John for the time being. I've got a feeling, though, within a couple of years, we're going to be on a very good first name basis. So thank you for joining us today. Charlotte, I see that you are on with us, and I really want to get the whole program started with an introduction of you. I can't go through all your credentials, but Charlotte is an American freelance writer, but she served as a senior policy advisor in the Office of Educational Research and Improvement with the U.S. Department of Education during the first term of the U.S. President Ronald Reagan. And Charlotte, I know you were brought into that office and told that your job was to help to dismantle the Department of Education. And in fact, over a period of time, you learned quite the opposite. You were put in that position, but they didn't intend on dismantling that organization at all. I want to thank you again for joining us. I'm real serious when I say you are an icon in the freedom movement. John and I had a little off-air conversation before this, and he said if there's a handful of people that are the true patriots that deserve national recognition and statues put up to them, you would be one of them. And I couldn't agree more. Thank you, Charlotte, for joining us. We'll let you start by explaining how you got involved in all this and how you were disappointed in the whole system.
All right. Maybe you should give lessons in, you know, stuff like this instead of esoteric things like the end of our brains.
Charlotte, keep your voice unmuted.
We're with William Bennett.
We
don't work with the neoconservatives.
Yeah, they got me in my pig dress there.
They are the Trojan horse at the moment.
Are you there?
They are introducing the charter schools, school choice, and we have to understand that although many of them may not understand what they're doing, they are the Trojan horse to change our form of government, believe it or not, through unelected councils. The unelected council system, very important. That's the Soviet system.
A false friend is more dangerous than an open enemy. And that's what we're fighting, the false friend.
I was asked to sign a statement, and a lot of people call me a liar, but I have witnesses, that promised I would pledge to teach the mission of world government. And even though the public education had always been tainted with a political bias, I finally was able to connect this political agenda directly to the UN.
Thus, by varying the situation, introducing conditions of reward and punishment, we are able to determine the cutoff levels at which a student will display positive behavior. In this way, it is possible to assess not only a student's predisposition to behave in a manner consistent with responsible citizenship, but also to provide some intensity of that predisposition across a wide spectrum of situations. This is B.F. Skinner to the max.
America was started in 1898. See how far back it goes? 1898. By socialist John Dewey. It was started by John Dewey in 1898 with his attack on the primary school's emphasis on teaching children to read. Dewey and his socialist colleagues were determined to change individualistic America into a collectivist society.
The two parts of Agenda 21 are imposed on us, and that is smart growth, moving populations into concentrated city centers for surveillance purposes and monitoring and manipulation, and the wildlands, which is getting people out of the rural and suburban areas, blocking access to wilderness roads and resources, and shifting land ownership from private to public.
Okay, Charlotte, I'm absolutely thrilled to see you here. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for being also someone who introduced me to John. I thank you for that. I have his book here in front of me. I've been reading through it, and it's just absolutely fascinating. So thank you, Charlotte. You are one of those people that connect everybody.
Well, I hope so. I'm meant to be connecting the dots now. And I have a very good friend in Maine who's been working on this for about 25 years, has her own connecting the dots thing, sort of. Mm-hmm. And I want to give her credit for making a huge, huge effort and not getting too far, just like I haven't, because she's been boycotted, shut out, as well as I have been as well. I do want to mention, I'm so glad you brought that Exposing the Global Road to Ruin video up. I want to right now tell the listeners out there that I am making that whole set of 7 or 8 videos. You know, they're all the old-fashioned video, VCR. Well, they're video. They're discs. Available free, including the shipping, for anyone out there who wants them, because when the YouTube goes down, you won't have them. I will send you, send me your email, me your name and address, and telephone number too would be good, but my, email me to dumbdown00@yahoo.com and say you want one copy of the video discs of the extraordinary two conferences we had free. That includes the shipping. I'm doing this because this is the most important history. We put it together, two conferences with the leading public school teachers, Sam Blumenfeld, the great, everybody knows him, myself, et cetera, where we covered everything you should know about. And you're getting it free. What really, is it that difficult for you to send me a postcard to my, well, you can email me. That's probably better. Well, I just told you, dumbdown00@yahoo.com. And you want me to send you and give me your address, one of the sets. The sets cost $30 before plus shipping. So you're getting something of great value. And I hope that, Dan, you can advertise it too. Nobody ever had an offer like that.
No, they haven't. And I have to tell you, Charlotte, I have that set, and it's absolutely amazing how much information is available on that. And it literally covers from soup to nuts why our education system in this country is in the shape that it's in. So thank you for doing that. And quite honestly, that's going to be your legacy is going to be the information that you're leaving for all these people to understand. This hasn't been happening in a short term. This has been happening for 200 years.
Oh, yes. Yes, it has. It started with, as I say, I like to say this to the media that says we're all crazies and we're conspiracy theorists. It started really back with the French Revolution. And mm-hmm. we have that wonderful book by John Robison. I have an original copy, 1798. He gave it to George Washington. And you know what he dared to call the book? Proofs of a mm-hmm. Conspiracy. Mm-hmm. He was a great scholar. In Europe, he was noted for astronomy, for agriculture, for everything. I don't think they called him a conspiracy theorist. He tells you exactly what was going to be planned, mm-hmm. 200 and some odd years ago.
Yeah, I have a copy of that book myself, and you're absolutely right. I mean, it's been going on since Adam Weishaupt and the Illuminati, and that people want to call that a conspiracy theory. There's no theory to it. It's fact. Everything we're going to be talking about are facts. And Charlotte, with that, I want you to tell our listeners how you got involved in the whole education industry. And that's the only way we can describe it. I think John calls it that too, the education industry. And how you began to realize just exactly how deep the education swamp is.
All right. I didn't intend to. I have to tell people I wanted to be a tennis player when I got out of business school, and I was going to be a tennis player. Well, I didn't get involved in, I worked in the Foreign Service and around the world for a while. And then we left the West Indies where we had a yacht charter business, nicest time of my life. And for some reason, well, I guess it was because my husband was a yachtsman, we went to Maine to live. Well, I had no idea. So I hit Maine, and I lovely little town of Camden, Maine, which is turned out to be a sort of the center of the wealthy come to Maine, right? And they're all liberals. They took over the town, and so I couldn't get elected dog catcher after a while because the Mainers were all my constituents. They had to move out because the liberal left out of Cambridge and everywhere else had moved in. And they wanted to put this agenda in, which we're talking about today. And anyway, I didn't know all that then. I did run for school board. I had no idea what I was getting into. And we had our Harvard professor. I mean, our superintendent came out of Harvard. He's a major change agent. We became very good friends. It's weird. He knew I knew. He knew I knew. And we would have little conversations after the meetings, because it was just too ridiculous to get into arguments at the board level. But to make a long story short, I was making a lot of noise, and all the people in town after the Mainers had left town, they couldn't afford it. They'd write about me in the newspaper, and I was, what was that? Oh, they called me, they said I was a kook. Yeah, that was the first. I was a kook because I'd complained about a little exercise in the community where the teacher, this came right out of Facing History and Ourselves, I think. No, it didn't come out of that. Was another one. It came out of a program that I had found, and had the teacher taking the little tots to town, any town USA, and having them point out the rich people's houses and the poor people's houses. What do they eat in the rich people's house? What do they eat in the poor people's trailer? Back and forth. And I thought, what? I'd lived abroad in communist countries and all, and I thought, what is this? This is class warfare. Oh, I went to school board meeting, and I said very politely, I said, I don't understand. This just doesn't seem appropriate. I mean, what are you doing? And I said, this is creating division between our children. And what's it all about? Well, I didn't talk for long. The next day, I was hauled up the flagpole as a kook. And anyway, then I continued on. And then I did, after all the beating up I had over the years from the people in the community, all the newcomers that came in, and the press, of course, I had and phone calls, I get really people angry with me and all. And a bad woman, she is a kooky woman. And I got a phone call one day, and I thought, oh, here I go again. Here we go. And this woman says to me, hello. She says, my name is Selma Hamm. And she said, I'm a master teacher, and I've lived and taught all over the world. And she said, I just want to tell you, you're absolutely correct. And I thought, finally. And then she said, I want to pay for you to go for change agent training. And so I said, what's that? And she said, you'll find out. And so she paid, and up I went to this lovely, I think it was in a lovely old congregational church on the coast of Maine. And we were a lot of nice school teachers from my district and principals and all. I knew them all, you know, good teachers. And the facilitator was Ronald Havelock's Innovations in Education, the book he was working from. One thing we were allowed to, it cost $100 to go to that change agent training. She paid for that. But the book was included. I still have it. And it was full of all of these mechanisms, drug ed, sex ed, critical thinking education. The only thing that was good, they didn't have that listed, was drug ed. I mean, driving ed, that was the only thing. Drug ed, sex ed, alcohol ed, all the critical thinking, horrible stuff. And I was absolutely shocked. And there was another meeting the next Saturday that I'd paid for, but I was so appalled because they told us the purpose of it was how to identify the resistors in your community. And I thought immediately, huh? That's me. I'm being taught how to identify myself. And I thought back to my visits, you know, when I was coming back from the Far East third class on a freighter at dinner at night. This was took about a month to get from Yokohama to Marseille. And every night we'd have dinner in third class. The French always have good food and a little bottle of wine. And I would talk to these people coming out of communist China and Vietnam, two women. And the woman out of China, she told me about her grandfather, who was a very famous pianist in communist China. And they cut his hands off. He was a resistor. They cut his hands off. I never forgot that. Then the Vietnamese woman told me her grandfather was a resistor too. And they cut his head off and they marched it around town on a pole, which was warning people, don't resist. So when I was taught, they were teaching me how to identify myself. That was the beginning of my trip.
Well, that was the beginning. Tell us a little bit about how you got placed as a special senior policy advisor with the Department of Education under Reagan and how that all evolved.
Well, I was lucky enough to know someone who I'd started the Maine Conservative Union in Maine in the 70s. It was a good group. We don't have anything like that anymore. Oh, you know, we had military people, we had doctors, we had lobster meat, everybody. And that was an affiliate of the American Conservative Union when it was good. It's now neocon completely. And I had a friend there who helped me get the Maine Conservative Union going. And we stayed very close friends for a long time. And then the Maine Conservative Union morphed when we found this horrible program in the sex ed for Maine, which had seniors at that time. It would be kindergarten now, teaching the seniors the three types of sexual intercourse, including with animals. Well, when I saw that, I thought, oh, we've got to morph something called Guardians of Education for Maine into the Maine Conservative Union. Well, we had all these military people who go by Robert's Rules and other people who were members in Maine, my Maine Conservative Union. But this former teacher and marvelous friend, she and I formed Guardians of Education for Maine. And we just sort of morphed it with Maine Conservative Union. And when we told the men, mostly men we had at our Maine, with our Maine Conservative Union, we informed them what we'd done. And they said, what have you women done? And we said, well, we just sort of felt that education was the key to the whole thing. And we hope you don't mind being merged. So we merged. And then Maine Conservative Union, because then I had to go to Washington, it sort of died. Guardians of Education for Maine stayed on. And we managed to knock that health education out of half of the districts in Maine, which came out of Berkeley, California, by the way. Surprise, surprise. And anyway, so that is the story there, how I went to Washington, because the individual with the American Conservative Union who got me to form the Maine Conservative Union, which I formed for after a while, we morphed it, and it became the principal group. She's the one that called me down. And I have to say this, Representative John Ashbrook, who's the late John Ashbrook, the wonderful John Ashbrook. I've dedicated my book to him. He was a congressman. He wrote us a letter to Guardians of Education for Maine, and he said there should be a group like that in every single state. And if you look in my book, you'll see quite a lengthy entry from John Ashbrook, his presentation to the Congress on the education bills that were being passed. He told them everything, and they did not listen. Anyway, so this is how I got down there. The Gallon White House personnel pulled me down. And I had no idea that I was getting into this office that had been the senior policy advisor prior to me, would have been the former president of Harvard or University of Chicago or wherever, you know, a real major change agent. And I had no credentials there. I'd had none of their credentials. I had the American parents' credentials. And so then I saw everything. I saw all the grants and contracts going out all over the world, not just, you know, they're not just spending your tax money still too, on American education. Mm-hmm. We were sending all this communist curriculum all over the world. Especially Skinner, outcome-based education. That was being worked on in the 70s and only popped its head in the 80s, really, when I was there. And then in the 90s, I knew what it was. And when I got myself fired for leaking Project BEST, Better Education Skills Through Jake, Technology, I saw that grant, and it said on it, one of the pages said what we can control and manipulate at the local level. And it was, that page was marked confidential. And I saw that when this project came across my desk, Project Best,
mm-hmm.
and I saw that and I thought, having been a local school board member and always very suspicious about the feds, that was it. Mm-hmm. That they dared say that. And then they listed the advisors, the curriculum specialists, the people in the community, change agents, everybody. And it was technology. And all of the old timers from the 50s, their research was in there. I want to make a point here, and Jake will understand this. I got into all the old research on technology, went down to the archives to get this stuff. The people that were involved in this grant earlier on,
mm-hmm.
these computer specialists who were developing courseware, they said, if you're in the business of developing the courseware and putting it on the computer, it doesn't make a difference whether you're a conservative or a liberal or what. If you don't agree with the message of the courseware, you don't do it. You have to have a conscience. This came from an educator who's working on this stuff way back in the 50s. That's very important because the computer can change the brain. You see, that's what Jake's into. So I saw that and I leaked it, but I'd gotten all the most important documents out of my office into my apartment prior to leaking it. There's a funny story.
Yeah, Charlotte, I just want to interject right here, though. President Reagan had run under a platform that said that he was going to eliminate the Department of Education. And you thought you were there to do exactly that when you first started. Tell about how that evolved.
You know, there's a funny conversation that I had before I went in. I remember one night I got a phone call and I was going to bed, and my bed was the size of my bedroom, actually. I couldn't even get out of bed hardly. It was an apartment in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And, the assistant secretary was going to be the assistant secretary. He'd been with the Republican Study Committee. He's dead now. And he was a good guy. And he called me before I'd been taken on board. And he said, we had a long talk, and he said, are you going to be loyal? And I said, well, of course. I didn't know what he meant.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. He meant, was I going to be loyal to Ronald Reagan? I thought he was talking about being loyal to the country. And I said, of course. And then I got in, and I was absolutely appalled. And he put me in every single office. I don't know why. I think he was good guy. He didn't want to do the dirty work that I was doing. He didn't have time either, being assistant secretary. So my job was to be the liaison with all the different groups, like the National Diffusion Work that puts out the 100% communist, absolutely guys destroying curriculum that went into every single state in the country. I was liaison with that. With School Choice, Nation at Risk, technology. Now, technology. The head of technology, Malcolm Davis, told me I had to go in there and, find out what all they were doing with computers and everything at that point. And he showed me some software, NEA software for math. It was very, simple. It looked pretty good. I said, gee, you don't even have to go to school for that. You know what he said to me? Charlotte, in the future, everything will take place. All education will take place in the home.
Mm-hmm.
Now think COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He told me that. At the time, it shocked me a bit, and I thought, that's a little crazy. How can that happen? But now I know with COVID.
Oh, yeah.
See? Mm-hmm. So that office and School Choice, that was my office too. I had all these individual offices plus public-private partnerships. Mm-hmm. So I was the liaison with the White House on the White House conference on privatization. Mm-hmm. I went over there. You know, here I am. I mean, honestly, I have no college education. I have business school, but I got a pretty good education, I guess, because I just looked at these people. There are about 100 of them, businessmen, ministers, all these people who were part of Reagan's private sector initiative. And I said, what are you doing here? Isn't this corporate fascism? And they said, oh, I don't know if anybody ever looked at it that way. And I thought, well, I do. You know, I never forget that. What's going on right now all over the world? Corporate mm-hmm. fascism. Mm-hmm. And so that really, that was pretty much gives you the background of my period in the U.S. Department of Education. Then I came mm-hmm. home. Then I wrote a little book, which I think I wouldn't have had to write the big book if the conservatives hadn't, from the minute I wrote Back to Basics Reform or Skinnerian International Curriculum, they boycotted it. They make sure that mm-hmm. book never went out. And, you know, later on, I looked at it and I thought, wow, no wonder. Mm-hmm. No wonder they didn't like that little book. I gave Bill Bennett a copy of it at a cocktail party once. I was that naive. You know, one of the Washington, D.C. dudes down there, you know, I just happened to finish with Phyllis Schlafly's Eagle Forum thing. And we were all, and Bennett was there. And he bought me a Bloody Mary, I think. And I said, oh, here's my little book. Like, maybe you'd like it. And so he takes it and he had a big pocket. It's a little book. He managed to get it in his pocket. And that was a big mistake because Bennett had it. And then it was boycotted, bang. And I say, that's the most important little book, and it's still available. Mm-hmm. The other one is $500 or something, you know, deliberate dumbing down is stupid, what you have to pay for. It's just ridiculous because it's out of print.
Right? Well, but tell our listeners, Charlotte, you've made that available pretty much free of charge. Just if they go on your website, they can get that book as a download, as a computer download.
It's a free PDF. And, you know, you're talking about if they go on my website. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure they can go on my website. But this morning is the first time in 20 years I've had that website where I can't get into my website.
Uh-oh. Yeah, well, I Charlotte, I have to tell you, we've experienced quite a bit of that this summer. Thumper and I both, we've had a number of our programs that just got dropped completely, or they put on the website that it's inappropriate material. That's always a crowd pleaser too.
Well, I think, you know, everybody else, I checked before I was going to email you that because I thought you couldn't get in. But I checked with people, and everybody except Charlotte can get in.
Mm.
I can't get into my own website.
Wow.
But my buddies out there, I say, look, you know, try to get into my website. And they go, it's here.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm happy about that. But mm-hmm. then when I was doing trying to prepare for this interview, I usually use my index, which I adore. The index mm-hmm. is the best part of my book. And I'm having a very hard time because I have an old copy of this one. Look, here it is. I've hidden all my other ones so nobody will steal them. I don't have mm-hmm. them. So here is my beat up. That's my beat up. Okay. Now look at the back. See, there's nothing on the back because I took the index off because I love to use the index.
Mm-hmm.
I think the index is the most important part of the book.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway,
yeah.
This is my only copy that I allow anybody to know where it is. But I say Back to Basics for your listeners is very important. It's up on my website.
Mm-hmm.
And had the conservatives not boycotted that book, well, maybe I should thank them.
Well, you know, actually, it shows how close you are, Charlotte, to the truth. The fact that you've had the kind of opposition you have is because you are someone who's been exposing this stuff for a very long time. I do want to get John into the conversation so that we can give him a little time, because he's been taking a lot of the stuff that you've been working on with technology. And his book, School World Order, really talks about how technology is going to be the order of the day that's going to move us into an entirely new way of learning. And it's not going to be pretty if it's not done in the correct way. So, John, thank you for joining us. Please tell us a little bit about your background and a little bit about the book School World Order.
Okay. Thanks for having me, Dan. So I'm a teacher. I teach college. I'm an adjunct professor, which means I'm, you know, I bounce around from several different community colleges. I'm kind of low on the totem pole, but it affords me the ability to fly below the radar and write a book like this that's basically against all the trendy stuff without getting the total boot from academia yet. I had written some stuff before I started writing on this topic. I never really intended to be so focused on education. I don't think I ever really intended to write too much about it, because, you know, working in academia, I thought I would keep a buffer, maybe write about other things and then keep some buffer between me and the upper echelons at work. But then something happened several years back, and this is what started the book. When Bruce Rauner was the governor of Illinois, he was stalling on the budget. And what I saw this as was a ploy to push everything that Charlotte just mentioned. And it wasn't just the fact that by stalling on the budget, he was forcing public institutions, including one of my own departments, to basically go bankrupt and then have to go into private receivership. So it was a ploy to privatize. I also saw him tossing out all of the buzzwords that Charlotte had mentioned in some of the interviews I'd listened to her on years back. And it all popped up at once. And since they literally took my job at that point, or at least one of them, I figured, well, you know, that buffer is gone. So I guess now is the time to, you know, speak the truth. And, you know, the buzzwords I saw Bruce Rauner throwing around were things like school choice, okay, which is a code word, is a dog whistle for public-private partnerships, either charter schools, which are private, either for-profit or nonprofit corporations. They get federal and state tax dollars, so it's private companies subsidized by government, which means it comes with government regulation. Other school choice venues include like vouchers, so they'll give somebody money, a family, federal dollars or state dollars, and you take that money and you pay for tuition at a private school. Others are education savings accounts and tax credits for tuition and things like that. But all of these basically take public tax dollars and they subsidize private companies. So at this point, it's neither public nor private. It's this incestuous merger of the public and private. You can call it communism, you can call it fascism, you can call it technocracy. And we'll talk about how that sort of is the common parlance between both what we might call communist or fascist mergers of state and corporate power. But those were the buzzwords that he was throwing around. Other ones had to do with cradle to career, which is basically another euphemism for school to work, which means workforce training. Okay, and so that means you're replacing traditional academics, the traditional classical liberal arts, changing the art of thinking or the art of how to think and changing it to the art of what to think for the purposes of workforce training. I'd also been going to some other conferences at the time, and I'd noticed they were pushing these things called P20 and P16 councils. This is another broader apparatus that combines the public and the private through these different either charter schools or community schools. And I remember the speaker at the presentation, he wanted to bring in the some dialogue, and he's asking questions about, like, who do you think would be good for these P20 partnerships? And, you know, it's that Delphi technique that Charlotte talks about. Really, they want to see somebody like me say, hey, I think this is no good. But what they also are trying to get you to do is provide the answers they already have, which is people saying things like, oh, it would be good to combine schools with the police departments. Oh, and it would also be good if we combine them with the mental health departments. And so you're not only merging the public and the private, but you're merging education with healthcare and criminal justice all into one monolith that's going to be micromanaged by technology. And so that was the third component, because I had been working with several other software programs as a teacher. And I noticed that some of them, one of them in particular, was partnering with IBM's Watson. IBM's Watson is an AI program. It can do everything from financial security to education, healthcare, can do your taxes for you. But the IBM Watson Education was partnering with one of the platforms I was using with, and it basically told us that it was going to pilot along and data mine what we did to improve its algorithms. Well, I just kind of surmised, looking way down the line, that so every day I go to work, I'm teaching this thing how to replace me eventually. And so all those things came together, and I basically saw it as the next phase, or getting started with the next phase of Project Best. I would say that now, after COVID, that is what has really driven the second phase. But but that's pretty much how I got started. I won't barrel into Project Best right away, but I could expand on that as well, as far as how the people involved setting it up, Bill Bennett being one of them, are now at the forefront of the new virtual schooling overhaul. So.
Yeah, I think this from day one, they had the concept, once they developed the technology, that they could eliminate, as you said just a few minutes ago, they eliminate how you think, how you learn, and teach you what you learn and what you should think. And that is the difference between a classical liberal education, which is not designed to give you specific things to think, but rather to give you ways to think, and turning that into technocracy. And I know you and I talked about it earlier. Patrick Wood, who apparently you've had some connection with Patrick, he's written quite a bit about that. He actually wrote a book with Sutton, called Trilaterals Over Washington. So anyway, that is something that, Charlotte, you've talked about B.F. Skinner. Skinner, Pavlov, all these ways of conditioning people how to think. That's at the basis of this, and that's what you've been trying to warn America about for a very long time, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd like to give credit. I can't take credit for ever knowing anything about B.F. Skinner until I met a teacher in Arizona, and her name is Ann Herzer. And I give her credit above any of us, even above Jake, I think, above Jake, above me. She knew what the Skinner method was because she had to go through the training. And she educated me. I didn't know anything about that. She went through the training. She went through the ECRI, Exemplary Center for Reading Instruction Training, Ethna Reed out of Utah, close to Terrell Bell, the Secretary of Education. And the American Federation of Teachers in Arizona, they were having hysterics over the Skinner method. And they all voted unanimously to sign a resolution to send it to Washington for the AFT annual meeting for Al Shanker to present to the members. They went to Washington with their resolution, unanimous, the American Federation of Teachers. They weren't that way all over the country. This was Arizona. And my friend and her friend, two of them went, and Shanker had the resolution, and he tabled it. All these behavioral psychologists were lined up next to the microphone and next to Shanker. They were all ready to speak against the Arizona Federation of Teachers. Now, that I want to point out, the average teacher doesn't want to have anything to do with this. I always say, why would anybody go into teaching? You know, it's hard enough to be a mother with children. Why would they go into teaching unless they, if they wanted to just be using computers? They wanted to have something to do with the development of the curriculum. This has been the greatest, you know, the teachers have been more abused, I say, than anyone. And I still say that because what's there out there, they're not teachers anymore. It's tragic. These young ones coming through, you know, they're not.
They're babysitters. Yeah.
They don't understand what teaching, really don't understand at all what teaching is. But Anne, I have to admit, I didn't know anything about, I love dogs. I train dogs, you know, German Shorthairs. I know how to train dogs. So when Anne came along in my friendship, because we were both concerned about education, and I visited her several times in Arizona, and she trained me, but she didn't give me a dog biscuit or anything. She just called me apple gin and tonic. But anyway, she is the one, and then she was, superintendent of schools in Arizona. And she, Carol Warner, was the left-wing Democrat superintendent at the time. And Anne had tremendous support from the Republicans and business people and everything. And then, Jake doesn't know this. This is interesting. Anne started talking about the computers and technology and Skinner. She lost all the business community support. And she didn't get, you know, she didn't get the nomination. And Carol Warner remained there. And Anne, I'm so glad that you allowed me to have a little time on this, because to me, she's it. I'm not. I knew nothing, but I ran with her message, and somehow God put me, you know, in the Department of Education, and I knew the great, you know, the head of NIE, well, who got fired too, because he wanted to get rid of his own office.
Now, well, you've mentioned a number of times in your book, and Jake, you've got it in your book about how they literally transpose psychologists into the roles of teachers because they know that they can shape the way these young people think.
And exactly. You know, it was okay before when they were trying to brainwash with all the rotten curriculum. And I remember that because when I was on the school board, they didn't have they were putting in the individualized education. They knew what they were moving towards, but they weren't talking about computers. And so I didn't really realize it, but so it was just plain, you know, rotten commie curriculum. Okay, just say it's a good commie curriculum. Now, that's not going to necessarily stick in a human being's mind or a student's mind. But when you use the computer, you can, it sticks. As Skinner, are so many quotes. The computer is my box, he said. I can make a pigeon a high achiever by reinforcing it on a proper schedule. Your children are pigeons.
Yeah.
So I didn't know before this happened. Yes, we had bad curriculum, very bad communist curriculum, but we didn't have the method. The method assures that your child is going to take, it's like a vaccine. It bypasses the brain. The Skinner method bypasses the brain. There's no thinking. There's no transfer going on. It's like I often say when we go to the doctor in the past, you know, he had that little metal thing with a rubber, at the like a hammer, rubber at the end, and he, to check your reflexes.
Right.
You pop it on your knee. Think hard here. What happened there? Your knee automatically, like your child, responds up. You can't keep it from happening. So this is what's happening to your children with a computer curriculum.
Well, and that's why when we talk about this, we talk about some of the things that could be positive about technology, how they're using it to destroy the way we think. And of course, I saw a beautiful interview that you did with Alex Newman, and Alex and Duke Pest have their program now. If everybody in America would follow their program for their kids, they would all be critical thinkers. They would all learn proper real history and things that would make them much, much better at discerning truth and lies. But the way this program is designed with the B.F. Skinner model is to train people not how to think, but what to think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's it. I mean, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think that's a direct quote from somebody. It's very good. I mean, mm-hmm. Yeah. And, of course, Jake, he gives far too much credit to me. I don't really understand why he does that. It's really nice because I have never been given much credit. Every conservative in the country, neoconservative, really turned on me. Mm-hmm. And that was hard to take. But there are good conservatives out there who aren't neoconservatives.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that the neoconservatives would just wake up. And don't they understand that they're really just as bad as the Marxists? They're Trotsky. Well,
yeah,
they're worse than the enemy because knew the enemy. I worked with the enemy for years in education. My superintendent, change agent, I found out that he was in a small meeting at one point, and they were talking about, he was talking about why he drinks. And he said he had to be in control of everything. And then he said, and one of the people in the meeting called me, and after the meeting, and she said, I have to tell you what he said. He said, I have to be in control. That's why I drink a lot. And he said, there's only one person in town I can't control, and that's Charlotte Enterby. Oh, yeah. And I thought, you know, all the town, they thought that we didn't get along. We were very good friends.
Mm-hmm.
The superintendent and I were good friends. We were on opposite sides. But for some reason, we had a very good relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved children. I have to say that. He loved children.
And it was
a communist change agent.
it was probably a respect for your intellect, Charlotte. And incidentally, on this network, and certainly with this radio host, you have very, very high, you come very, very highly regarded. So,
thank you very much.
We're glad you're here because the fact is you've done more to expose the flaws in public education than virtually anybody in the country. And I include John Taylor Gatto in that as well.
John, it's too bad he's gone because he served as a treasure.
Yeah, very much so. Well, okay, let's get back. I want to get back to John. And John, I want you to talk about how what Charlotte was talking about, this transition into computers, and just exactly how that is being planned to shape our future, and how it's happening under the current administration as well, under Voss, how all that is alive and well in this country. Let's talk about that.
Okay, great. So the Skinnerian psychological conditioning method actually can be traced back to the 1800s with Wilhelm Wundt, who was the founding father of psychology as a laboratory science. So before that, psychology was a subdiscipline of philosophy. And Wilhelm Wundt, basically, you know, the original root of the word psychology does not mean the study of the mind. It means the study of the soul. Wundt basically said that, well, you'll never be able to measure the essence of that, but you can actually control the essence of the soul through its outcomes, okay, or its behaviors. In other words, through the nervous system, through a thing he called stimulus response conditioning.
Okay. This is what becomes the basis for classical conditioning, like Pavlov's dog stuff. So in a natural environment, the natural stimulus of food elicits a natural response of salivation. You can therefore condition the dog to practice other behaviors if you associate artificial stimuli with the natural stimuli. And through that association, you can get the dog to behave in response to the artificial stimuli the way he or she would to the natural stimuli. So you ring a bell with the food, and the dog associates the bell with the food. Eventually, you can ring the bell, and the dog will salivate as if the food is in front of him, or even if it's not. So you just take that principle, and then they kind of make it a little more sophisticated over several decades. You get people like John B. Watson, who was a student of John Dewey, by the way, and E.L. Thorndike, who come up with this thing called behaviorism. It's still classical conditioning. It's still stimulus response. They just add punishment and reward cycles to it. And it's actually E.L. Thorndike that comes up with what he called his puzzle box experiments that become B.F. Skinner's Skinner box experiments. So putting the pigeons in the mazes, putting different animals in the cages, having them push levers to get food, having them perform particular tasks that are a little more routinized through punishment and reward. And actually, it was E.L. Thorndike who came up with really the he's one of the first people to think of the idea of automated learning. He basically said that if you could design a book so that the student could not go to the next page unless he or she completed the activities within the previous page, you could basically automate the learning through the page book. So B.F. Skinner takes that concept and puts it onto computers, analog computers. So this would be around the time of like cathode rays and like IBM punch cards. So you didn't have digital computation the way we do now. But the algorithms would have been calculated through the gears and wheels and the reel of tape. Okay, so you take the learning stimulus is going to be question and answer, multiple choice, matching, short answer, stuff like that. You're going to put it on a reel of a tape, and then the response is going to be what the student answers. So whatever letter he or she puts for the matching or for the multiple choice or the short answer that's scribed. And then it only goes in one direction. So after the student puts in the response to the learning stimulus and turns the gear, he or she cannot go backwards. Now, if the student's really good, it'll come up with an algorithm that says, hey, you're ready for gifted or high achieving curriculums. But if the student is slower, it's going to say, no, you need to do workforce training, and you need to do this particular type of workforce training, because based on your cognitive behavioral algorithms, based on the speed and efficiency of how you respond to the learning stimuli, we know that you can only push buttons and pull levers. You can't actually do higher thinking. Okay. And so take that concept and put it into something that's called adaptive learning software today. This is the modern Skinner box. So you just remove the reel of tape and the gears and the wheels. A good way to vision it is I always use the example of the ViewMaster. So when I was a kid, they used to have these ViewMaster things, these little goggles. You put them on your head, and they had a little disc that you put in there, and it had scenes from Disney. And then you pull the button, and you can see different scenes based on each one that you push. It's kind of like that, except it's questions and answers, and you have to respond to what's on the wheel. Just remove the reel of tape, remove the gears and wheels, put it on digital windows and clicks on a mouse. And it's the same idea. The only difference is that it's perhaps a little bit more sophisticated in the sense that the algorithms might data mine. They might be a little more specified in terms of the dynamism of the stimulus. So what I mean by that is, they can put like interactive media, they can gamify it is a trendy word they use. So make a video game where, you don't even know you're learning because you're playing this game, but it's still data mining how efficiently and how fast you do it. And it's going to give you it's going to personalize your curriculum either towards, I guess what they would consider more a high achieving, or it's going to be mainly geared towards the career pathways. I should mention that some of the important companies
that facilitate adaptive learning software are intimately tied to the people that started Project BEST. Okay, so Charlotte mentioned Bill Bennett, and I can understand why it was a mistake to give him back to basics, because Bill Bennett, who basically Project BEST was set up by T.H. Bell. But it was only a year later that it was handed off to Bill Bennett. So Bill Bennett had it for most of the time. Now, Project BEST is the beginning layers of setting up the scanner box technology through the public-private partnerships. Well, Bill Bennett sets up one of the biggest and most powerful online education charter schools in America called K-12 Inc. Bill Bennett's speechwriter when he was Secretary of Education was Peter Thiel, Bilderberger Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel is invested in adaptive learning software. In particular, he's invested in Clever and Newton. Peter Thiel also met privately. I have a FOIL request in my book that demonstrates he met privately with Betsy DeVos. Now, we don't know during one of her early education tours, we don't know exactly what they talked about because it was privately at his home, but we can assume that it had something to do with whatever he discussed with Bill Bennett based on the adaptive learning software being facilitated through K-12 Inc. and other online charter schools such as Pearson's Connections Academy. And by the way, Pearson partners with IBM and IBM's Watson, and IBM had people that sit on the new federal distance learning innovation rules. The code is 85FR18638. And there's an IBM representative that sits on those new regulations. Well, if you look at the regulations, 90% of it is competency-based education, which has to do with self-paced, personalized learning at your own pace, which means it has to be through a subscription. And the way that they say that it can be facilitated is through, quote, adaptive learning software. And they define it as artificial intelligence. And they even, there's a clause in there that demonstrates that the feedback does not have to be exclusively from an instructor. So they're already setting up the new distance learning regulations to make it so that in order for your credits to actually be transferable and accredited, you don't have to have a human interaction on the other end. There doesn't have to be interaction with a human instructor. You just have to have algorithms from your adaptive learning software, which is the Skinner box technology. And so while we're all forced to be stuck at home and using virtual distance learning technologies, even if you're at a public school, it doesn't matter where you're at. If you can't go back to school, you have to use this stuff. And so they're dishing out CARES money, government money, to pay and subsidize these companies to use the Skinner box technology in your house. So your house is now the corporate government building that they're using free of charge to facilitate that brainwashing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the corporate fascism that Charlotte was talking about. I know that this has been happening with the COVID-19 thing. I see it as being a great little facilitator, but something that Charlotte's brought up and you've brought up in our conversations is how all this stuff is interconnected. Agenda 21. All these programs that technocracy, all these things are intertwined. It's no wonder that the swamp is as deep as it is, because in fact, all these different ideas and these different groups are working together. And Betsy DeVos was actually a big proponent of Common Core originally. So let's talk about how this is impacting the Trump administration and how you see that all working together. And I'll ask you to start it, John, and then we'll move to Charlotte on that.
Okay, yeah, great. So other than the new distance learning regulations, there is also the CARES Act grants. Now, the CARES Act in general is going to hand out stimulus money to schools in general. But then there's two special competitions so you can get extra CARES money. The first one is rethinking K-12. Rethinking K-12 is the basis of it. I can't remember the rest of the title, but it's rethinking K-12 curriculums or pedagogy or something like that. The second one is reimagining workforce training or reimagining the workforce. Okay, so both of these have several hundred million dollars available. They've already issued several of the awardees.
But both of those, the Rethinking K-12 competition is all about building technology infrastructure, which means the adaptive learning software, and then other stuff that they say is not yet imagined. And that would be stuff like the biofeedback wearables for something called socio-emotional learning. Betsy DeVos has also been a proponent of, and I've got documents in there that demonstrate that. So those are some of the ways that the Trump administration right now is forwarding both the technology stuff, the adaptive learning, the Skinner stuff, and also changing the academics to workforce training. In the meantime, there are also some other reimagining competitions. So notice that they're using the same language. And this is this buzzword that they use for everything now, obviously, right? They even have reimagining policing, which, by the way, is all about big data and data tracking as well. But so the other thing that is supplementing the CARES Act grants and also the CARES competitions, which are funding all the stuff we're talking about, is there's a couple of Gates Foundation. Well, there's many Gates Foundation grants, but there's a couple in particular that are facilitating his partnership with Reimagining Education in New York. And that is a partnership with the Gates Foundation, Governor Cuomo, and also Eric Schmidt, who is the technical advisor at Alphabet, which is the parent company of Google. And basically what's happening with this project is a good window into it is if you look at a nonprofit company called Innovate EDU, which is funded by the Gates Foundation and is based in New York, it is getting money shortly after it got the Gates Foundation grants. It has announced has a Google Classroom connector application that will take student and teacher data that was collected through Google Classroom. It'll send it to Google's BigQuery, and Google's BigQuery is basically this big database where you can aggregate all sorts of other data for learning analytics and other predictive analytics, either for workforce planning or for developing better ed tech. Okay, or for other administrative planning purposes at the school level. So it's going to take all your student data. It's going to take the student's thinking data, cognitive behavioral, meaning through the adaptive learning software, and also their neurological or emotional affective data through adaptive or through biofeedback wearables. They're basically going to regulate stuff like their skin conductivity, heart rate, blood pressure, even facial recognition stuff that says that demonstrates whether or not they're paying attention. And so based on the student's thinking algorithms and the student's feeling algorithms, I'm going to put that stuff in these big query databases. And eventually it'll be used for social credit databases. And I can unpack that later, but I probably ran it long enough.
We've had that discussion with Dr. Michael Rechtenwald. You probably know Michael, but he is the NYU professor that was a hardcore communist, and he started speaking out against the things that were going on with political correctness, and ultimately he was brought into the faculty to the administration and they banned him, and now he's one of us. And boy, what a find. He wrote a book that you might want to check out. It's called Google Archipelago, and it's about the social credit system in China and how it's being adapted to be used in the United States by Google. So, Charlotte, I want to get you back into this discussion because, gee, look at how all these dots connect. We're talking about policing, and we're talking about psychology, and we're talking about education, and we're talking about all these things. Just think how easy it would be if they just chipped us so that they could tie all these things together, and then they could, if we did anything wrong, they could be able to immediately get to identify us and to hold us. This is all part of what you've been talking about for 25, 30, 35 years.
Yeah, I think I thought it was going to be pretty bad, but I don't think I ever dreamed that it could be this bad, where we've absolutely been sort of shut up except with people like you and all. But I mean, as far as the dialogue about philosophy and where countries should go and shouldn't go and history and all, nobody cares about that anymore. Everything is COVID. And people are afraid, and I hate to see this because this isn't the way I think America was meant to go. I don't want to forget this one thing, which is very important. In the late 90s, I think it was under George Bush Sr., perhaps the New American School Development Corporation, they asked for proposals for the new school, type of schooling. And we education researchers, pretty nasty little crowd, one of us found a proposal. I think it was out of Iowa. And it was for homeschoolers. And homeschoolers, listen. It talked about the homeschool. It was a proposal for a homeschool to be involved in one of the new types of education, where it had a picture of the community and the homeschoolers, and then at the middle it had the superintendent. This is for homeschoolers who think they can get away with homeschooling without having the government knowing everything and shutting them down. And so everything they do it on the computer was going through to the school superintendent. Now, you know, even Papa Bush, was it Papa Bush? 1998? Yeah, probably. I think that they realized that was a little bit too much to let anybody know about. So they didn't deal with that proposal. But I'm trying to tell homeschoolers that there's no way that they can be involved in any of this, no matter what it is. Scholarships, no matter what it is, they're controlled. They're going to be controlled. Unless they operate like the great Pastor Patrick out in Illinois, who's had a private school in East Moline for 30 years now, or 25. Not a penny anywhere, through any means, through any tax exempt, nothing. So I warn the homeschoolers, if you don't want to have what's happened to them in Europe, you better be very, very careful. That particular proposal, if that ever gets accepted, don't go for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Charlotte, you bring up a really important point, too, and that is we now have this data collection center in Utah that literally monitors every keystroke of every computer and everything we do. The more we get education computerized, use the technocracy that John's talking about, the more easily identified the people are that are outside the system.
No, it's absolutely awful. And, you know, I hope we can deal with the subject, which is, of course, I think the major subject people don't know about. It's community education. Now, this has been, they have it all over the world, by the way. We didn't realize that in the beginning. The community education is defined by the community educators, at least in the 70s, early 70s, at a community education conference, where a very good friend of ours, our finest researcher, she died a couple of years ago, Australian. She did all the research. She went to a meeting. By the way, everything rotten comes out of Australia, New Zealand, right? It's been that way for a long time because they're under the Queen, huh? Anyway, sorry, Queen, huh? But anyway, this was a conference of community educators. And the facilitator, the presenter, had come from Alaska. It was in the early 70s. And so one of the participants or in the audience, one of the educators said, "What is community education?" Now, let me tell you, it's going in all over the country now, folks. You may not even know it. It comes in under other names, et cetera. And he said, where does it come from? He said, I guess he asked where it came. He said, it's communist Chinese. Now, this has been going on for a long, long time with, under the radar. It ran into obstruction. We were all very much opposition in the 70s. We had brilliant researchers. And on that disc set that I'm making free to people, there's one disc that is written submissions. It's a CD, huh? Oh, look, there have been people on Amazon who've reviewed this thing and seen it. They say the written submissions are worth the whole, all the disc sets. You have Maureen Heaton, you have all the great researchers, and you have this one by Ruth Feld. She's dead now, from Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Community education is Chinese communism. And it's going in now. They had to slow down for a while because we did a lot. We did work. I'll tell you, I mentioned it on the Alex Newman thing. We did work in Maine fighting it. So we had a big brief with tabs and all, got to Governor Longley, our wonderful governor back in the 70s. He's dead now. But he got a hold of it, and he called me one night at 2 a.m., and he said, I'm calling you because I can't call you from the office regarding this. Community education. Mm. They're really pushing it hard in Maine. And I've looked at this brief, and it's the most devastating thing I've ever seen. Because it had all the tabs. Now, the brief that Ruth Feld and Jill Wilson did that is on the disc set, the written submission, is terribly important because I think it's a little picture of the community. It looks like now, with everybody's in there, Rosa Corey also is to be thanked because she understands this. She knows that we're all going to be herded in the cities into the stack and pack like China.
Right.
And now we see we can have everything delivered. We don't have to even go out. I miss going to the post office may go down, too. I miss talking to the post office people. I miss going to the grocery store. I miss going to the I don't want to be shut up in a stock and pack. And that's the way we're moving. And I think what we're looking at now with COVID, people are going to say maybe she's crazy. But I think this is just a really nice rehearsal to see
absolutely
put up with them telling us everything we have to do. We can't go shopping. We can't talk. We have to wear a mask. That means shut up, et cetera. And we have to stay in our houses, which is very unhealthy. And as I said to Alex, what do you do if you have a fight with your husband? What did Alex say?
Well, the thing is,
hide in the bathroom.
Well, Charlotte, think about it. If the computers are controlled like they are, like the Google archipelago with the social credit system, which is prevalent in China, and we have all these things in place, and you have to stay home, you literally have no way to communicate with anyone unless they approve it.
It's just horrible. I mean, I think all of us are beginning to appreciate people we did. I always appreciate the people in town anyway who make the country work, you know, downtown. But, you know, the postmaster and the gals who deliver your mail and the people at the grocery store, the liquor store, the UPS, you know, these are really, when you live out in the country like I do, these are my friends. And sorry, folks, I'm not going to give that up. I mean, for people who are willing to go along with the COVID lies, they're going to deserve what they get.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, do they really think it's going to be worth it? I mean, personally, of course, I could say this because I'm ancient and I probably don't know how much time I have left, but they could say, oh, well, you know, she doesn't have much time left anyway. So she can say no to the shot, huh? Maybe I wouldn't have said no when I was 60 or something. I think I would have because I just know it's going to be worse.
Yep.
What they've got for us is going to be a lot worse than what we're going to see on the other side unless we all go to hell.
Well, it's up to us to make sure that doesn't happen. But at the same time, you know, the Gates Foundation, Bill Gates talked openly about how they will use nanochips. They will use AI. They will use DNA modifiers. I mean, if you put this into your system, you're no longer 100% human.
No.
I mean, in fact, this is a prelude to being a cyborg.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know how it's I don't believe anybody, you know, even my buddies on the left and all, I get along better with the left than I do with the right, really. Because as Jake said, you know, you can talk to these people.
Yeah, they're a little more honest about.
Often they'll come around too.
Yeah. Well, I've not had too much luck with the coming around thing, but the one thing about it, they'll tell you what they are, you know, and they won't try to hide it.
Yes. But, you know, I've never had a single member of the left go against my books. Not one.
Wow.
Not one. Am I a communist?
I don't think so, because I know communists. I don't know if I told you this, but my father was a communist.
Oh, well, that's and, good.
You know, yeah.
It is.
Yeah, exactly. I know exactly how they work. So,
but really, it's true. And I think that they never said anything. And I know that they immediately, when the books came out, it was the conservative movement that boycotted everything, because they're not communists, but they're money people.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that this is a money game. You see, it's the public-private partnerships. It's the it's industry. It's corporate. It's not capitalism anymore. I mean,
well,
Carl 34 said, you know, in that book, great book, Conclusions and Recommendations, they said, we've got to get rid of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, we have. We've now got corporatism. And that's what Jake's talking about.
And now they're talking about eliminating all the monetary systems and having a one world digital currency. I mean, you talk about total control. It doesn't get any more total than that. They, if you speak out, they just cut off your social credit, cut off your wallet, and you're done.
Do these things pop off your head? They have to. I mean, I can't stand it. You know, thank God I lived when I lived, even though we had the last century awful wars and terrible things going on. But as I said in that last interview, you know, people were normal then, you know, even if they disagreed with you, they were polite.
You had civil society.
Yeah, we did. We did. And now it's like it's worse than the jungle. I mean, I've got all these wild animals around here that I just adore. And none of them, I think they, if they could talk, they would say, oh, sure, I feel so sorry for you having to deal with those people.
Well, we go back to things. Let's talk about that, because you say neocons. You mentioned neocons, and you know, I look at some of the people that have been part of the neocon movement. But let's talk about the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, they literally own our country. They own the decision making process, and there's not a truer group of neocons than the CFR.
But they're open. You can, you know, they don't keep quiet. Now, let's talk about the big guys. The Order of Yale.
Let's go back to that. Yes, let's go back to that.
Through the years, I knew Sutton pretty well. And, you know, it took him, he had to see the catalogs with all the members that I gave him to take a look at. Because he didn't understand. He said, where is this coming from? I don't get it. And that was really interesting that morning. My dad was, I was taking care of him. He's dying, taking care of him in New Jersey. My father was a member of the order, and my grandfather, I'm sorry, folks, forgive us. And it was so strange, because the same day Sutton called me. Prior to Sutton calling me, the mailman brings me these catalogs which I saw, Black Books, Mark Catalog, with all the members of the order since 1832. Underneath, telling everything they'd done, etc. I didn't know much then because Dad never talked too much, although he did say a few things at the end that were very, very important to me. At the end, before he died. But I took them into him. And I said, these three boys. He said, they never did that before. And I said, what? He said, they never published the names in their books. And I thought, oh, yeah. Huh? Well, then Sutton that day called me. Just so happened. And he said, you know, I just can't figure out where is this coming from? I'd studied the CFR, the Trilateral Committee, written about all of them, right? He said, do you know anything about the order? And I said, oh, it's strange you should call me today because I just got the catalogs. And he said, you what? And I said, yeah, I did. You know, the dad and the living and both together. And he said, would you mind lending them to me? And I said, no, I don't mind. I'll get them to you. And he said, I'll get them back to you right away. And he did. But the more I look at it, there was a commissioner of education by the name of Harold Howe under Lyndon Johnson. And I was reading an old National Educator journal out of California. Wonderful people. I saw Townsend's and all. These were the great conservatives. Alan Stang, you know, what's his name? Who wrote an undercover conspiracy. All these people knew everything, huh? Back then. And they had something called the National Educator. And I was reading this old article. And it was written by, what's his name? Scott in Virginia. It had been republished in the National Educator about the education czar. That was what the article was called. And it talked about Harold Howe and how he wanted to destroy the our nicely mowed backyards and these families who send their kids to camp in the summer and all this stuff. And I thought, whoa, who is this guy? I mean, he's really bad. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to go look in the Black Books. So I went to the catalogs, Skull and Bones. There he was.
Mm. Wow.
Then I knew what Sutton wanted to know. Mm-hmm. It's the order at Yale. And I remember, Dad, forgive me for even quoting you, but you changed at the end because he said he'd help me at the end, right? But when I started writing about education and I was on the school board and all, and I've been writing about it, and he said to me one day, Char, you're a good writer, but I don't think I know, I like what you're writing about. And I thought, you know, because I had no knowledge of what they did at Yale, the order. I didn't know. They didn't talk about it much. And I always thought, what did Dad mean? Because he was mayor of several towns. He was always supporting the Constitution. And I never knew. And then, you know, I was thinking about it the other day. I was thinking, well, how come you're so slow? Because the order controls education, which is the title of Sutton's book that he said was his favorite book. Mm-hmm. How the Order Controls Education.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing. And the CFR and all these different groups, they connect the dots. They bring it all together.
You just need, they're out, they make their names public. The order doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
I did this with Newman. Alex, there's one of Sutton's books, the major one, on the establishment, one of the versions that Chris Milligan published. It has on the back, you know, it's a cover, sort of a paper cover.
Mm-hmm.
And it has this extraordinary comment, which just sealed in my head the fact that it's the order. It's nothing else. And it says there, It's a quote from a member of the order that my dad knew. My dad went to Hotchkiss with him, the prep school. And it says there, it's a letter that he wrote to an older member of the order, Yale, in regard to a congressional hearing on communism in the United States. And he said, as long as we have someone himself from the order testifying at that meeting, we should have no problem.
Mm-hmm.
Got it?
Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
Well, it's only on the back of one of the versions of Anthony's books. And someday I'll ask Chris. Chris probably thought, well, you know, that's so dynamite that it is dynamite. Mm-hmm. In other words, he's saying they're that important. If they can get one of their people to go testify at a congressional hearing, they're going to get their way.
Well, I know, Charlotte, that you were actually became friends with Norman Dodd, and you talked with him about the connections with the Ford Foundation, the fact that they openly stated, CFR openly stated, that their goal was to merge communism with capitalism under a new world order. I'm paraphrasing, but that's right. Anyway.
So, yeah. Well, it was a merger of the United States and the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
That's the key, and that's what Reagan did, and Eisenhower. Eisenhower was the first.
Yeah.
First president to have a merger with the USSR in education and cultural stuff. And then along came Reagan, who did the same thing.
And well,
the foundation and all those neocons supported this.
Well, and there was a point back in the 90s, and I don't know, I guess it was probably, I don't know, it'd probably the Clinton administration, but didn't they do an official merger of the Soviet system of education with the United States? Maybe it was under Bush. I don't know.
No, it was under Bush. It was always, but they did have, it was under Clinton, I guess, that Louis Freeh, who was head of the FBI.
Oh, yeah.
He went to Moscow and he embraced the head of the FRB or the KGB or whatever, saying it's on that wonderful. It's on, you know, media picked it up.
I saw it.
They're partners now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that. I saw that very much. Jake, I want to get you back in the discussion because you've been listening to everything we've been talking about. Tell us how that has evolved under the new technocratic system and how all this is working under the system we're dealing with right now.
Okay. So maybe I'll talk more about the implications of social credit in terms of the data stuff. I can circle back around to the order after I'm done. I'll do one thing at a time if you want, but I'll start with your question, which is, so the contact tracing, I would say, is the beginning of social credit. Why do I say that? Because before COVID, as I'm looking at the P20 councils and the public-private partnerships, you look at the P20 councils and you see stuff like, and I mentioned this at some of the stuff they discussed at the meeting. You'll have a criminal justice representative, you'll have a healthcare representative, you know, and that includes both biological, physical health, and also mental health. And so what that means, though, is I'm going, you can't do that. Like, you know, education records go under FERPA, which is Federal Education Rights and Privacy Act. And you have your HIPAA, which is for your health care and your insurance. And then criminal justice is under its own jurisdiction separately. And each of these public institutions keeps its records separate from the others. And nobody has access to each other's. And this is what's called privacy. And, So I figure, as I'm writing the book, I'm looking at, well, gradually they'll slowly blur these things together until you really can't tell the difference, and they'll whittle away at the actual statutes as they go. I didn't think that when COVID happened, it would basically just smash them all together at once. So what is the contact? How does the contact tracing app fit into this? Well, if you're going into a school and they're going to take your temperature, and or there's one I saw, I sent it to Charlotte the other day. Well, there's a contact tracing app that they want you to wear at one of these colleges. I believe it's in New Jersey, and you can only go so many miles from the campus. Otherwise, you're in big trouble. I don't know if you get kicked out or what they do. But then there's another one. It's not a college. So I don't know. I remember if it was middle school, grade school, or high school, but it's you're already minor. They are minor students under parental guardianship. And they have to wear a temperature. They don't just go in and get the temperature at the beginning of the day. They have to wear a bracelet that monitors their temperature 24 hours a day, or at least as long as they're on campus. And this thing's getting constant biofeedback. So what does that mean? Well, it means that the school, who is regulated under FERPA, is basically taking medical data. And what is it doing with it? Well, I'm at a stalemate at some of the schools where I work. I'm being more proactive at one before I do it at both. And then if I get success there, I'll take that strategy to the next one. But I'm just trying to figure out, what are y'all going to do with this data when we take these temperatures? They don't give you a legal, like a privacy statement that you would get when you buy technology. You know, the thing is so long that if you actually tried to read it, you'd never leave the store. Like, that's what I want to see. I want to see a legal document. What are you doing with the data? They give us this cute little pamphlet with our school graphics on it that says, oh, you need to take your temperature, and then we might have to submit you to medical review. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that when you do my medical review, am I going to end up with an ankle bracelet on me like the man in either Kentucky or Tennessee? Or what contact tracing database does this data go to? Does it go to a particular contact tracing database where, especially if you're in a city where there's lots of rioting, like in Minnesota, where they use the contact tracing apps to track protesters and other violent insurrectionists, et cetera. So in other words, you go to the school where it's directed by FERPA, you submit your bio data for this medical review for the contact tracing, and then potentially it goes into a criminal justice database because they didn't like what you posted on Twitter based on whatever your political beliefs were about a protest or whatever else. So what they're seeing is the merger or the blurring together of your educational records, your healthcare records, and your criminal justice records, all through the same technology, all through the same data. And so what is that? That's basically social credit. If you've ever seen what it looks like in real time in China, you are not just given access to finances based on how you spend money. You're given access to the public square, everything from transportation to healthcare, housing, due process, education, jobs. All of that is based not just on how well you manage your money, but also how you behave in real time, not just what you post online, not just what you play on an online video game, but also, yes, how you perform on your educational modules, how you behave in real time with in the public square, like through a 3D facial recognition camera. So, you know, did you cut in line at the store, or did you put, and not just as you purchase it, but as you're in the shop, if you put stuff in your shopping cart, your score goes up or down. Okay, mm-hmm. So basically, if you're going to restrict or dictate somebody's our access to both the school and then potentially to the doctor and then other criminal repercussions based on a single submission of data, just because that's social credit. I would say that's definitely social credit. And you know, I might just add to that, you know, you mentioned kind of towards the chip, you know, in other words, the transhumanism. This is the end game of the whole project, which is just the second phase of eugenics. And, you know, as I've mentioned several times on several interviews, you know, if they can mandate not only contact tracing, but also mandate the jab, the vaccine, for the sake of managing public health, and they have set the legal precedent that they can either attach technology to you or insert technology in you for the sake of public health. And that doesn't just mean physical, like, well-being. It also means mental health. So in other words, if they think that, you know, the stuff you posted about masks or the corona data, which recently, I guess, I just saw CDC data today, CDC data that says only 6% of the COVID deaths are actually confirmed as nothing but COVID. Everything else has some other comorbidity. Okay, so if you post that online, and they're already doing this, you mentioned you send stuff out where they say, one of my articles got this. I clicked on it just to go into it through my Twitter, and it said something about, oh, it's dangerous article, and it had like this bright red color, like I opened a virus, and I'm going, what? This is my article, and I look at it, and it's like, it might be misleading information. Well, if it's misleading, then there's articles where they say you might be a sociopath if you don't want to wear your mask. So now you're mentally ill because you want to speak the truth. And if you're mentally ill, now you are a public threat in terms of your mental health. We're going to give you Elon Musk Neuralink. He just came out with another press release, I think yesterday or the day before, where they're ready for human trials. And they can go ahead and put that chip in there and give you a nice little readjustment for the sake of public health. And this is not just me surmising. As I mentioned, transhumanism is the culmination of eugenics. If you look at Oliver Wendell Holmes, Supreme Court Justice, his ruling on how it was justified to sterilize Carrie Buck, he appeals to, I believe it's the case of Massachusetts versus Jacobson. It was a case wherein the man lost the right to not be, he had to pay a fine, so it's not quite the same as they came and stuck him with the needle, but they said that it was legit that he was, that the public could force him to at least pay a fine if he didn't get his mandatory vaccination. In other words, the laws governing mandatory vaccination, Oliver Wendell Holmes claimed, would also justify eugenic sterilization. So it's not a far cry to say that they could use a forced vaccination law to justify forcing a chip in you for mental health. And I guess I'll just end with going to the order, because the first neural implants were created by Jose Manuel Rodriguez Delgado. This was either the late 50s or early 60s. I always get it mixed up. I wrote an article called "A Free Market Future of Brain-Computer Interfaces, A Techno-Fascist History of Neo-Eugenic Transhumanism." And it shows how Delgado, who was at Yale when he did this, was surrounded by Bonesmen. The only Bonesman I can remember off the top of my head is Frank Davis Ashburn, but there's three of them. And they all helped in facilitating the funding and his research at the mental hospital where he implanted neural implants in people that said that they were either had some sort of inability to control their emotions, and it was very crude. He would put them in, and basically based on these frequencies, he wanted to see, you know, could you calm somebody down, make them more aggressive, make them less sexually compulsive, and things like that. And eventually, interestingly enough, based on what we're talking about right now, they wanted to use that stuff to quell, quote, inner city riots. So, you know, it's a straight line from the order to eugenics and transhumanism. And I can name a bunch of people that funded the Nazis, like E. Roland Harriman, Prescott Bush, Knight Woolley, and I could go on. Let me give up the microphone.
Well, no, I this is fascinating because you're covering a lot of areas that we need to understand. And incidentally, they're at the Prime Minister of New Zealand now is talking about creating, in essence, concentration camps where people who test positive, and they insist on testing everyone in New Zealand, anybody who tests positive is going to be put into one of these camps. And if they refuse to take the test, they'll be put there automatically, and they won't be able to leave until they get the go-ahead from the New Zealand government. I mean, this is straight out of the New World Order. This is straight out of the concentration camps of the Nazis. Anyway, the fascinating story. Charlotte, getting back to you, we've got 15 minutes left, and I want to make sure that we cover all the things that you think are incredibly important that our listeners hear. And we've covered so many things. I also want to give you an opportunity to make sure that they have access to all of your information.
Yes. Well, I don't have, I'm not able to access my information on the internet myself because I can't pull up my website. So, yeah, I'm lost without my website, but nobody else is, everybody else can pull it up. I hope I shouldn't be saying that. They're going to pull yours down too. But I have one little thing here. I talked to Jake about it earlier in my little Back to Basics book.
Mm-hmm.
This relates to what Jake was talking about a bit. It's on page 16 of the original copy of this. And it's called Internationalists Want New Values Modifying Existing Beliefs. And I'm going to read this quickly, hope to. According to the March-April 81 issue of Human Intelligence International Newsletter, critical thinking skills, they're very important. Critical thinking has nothing to do with what you think it has to do with. It's brainwashing. It's taking place within UNESCO, OECD, and the World Bank, which plans on increasing the bank's international lending for education and training to about $900 million a year. That's back in 1981. The Department of Education's National Institute of Education, possibly in response to a meeting Luis Alberto Mercado, the Venezuelan Minister for Human Intelligence, that's what we're talking about, had with former Secretary of Education Terrell Bell and various senators to update them on the progress of his nation's work in human intelligence. Quote, has awarded a three-year contract totaling approximately $780,000 of your tax money to Bolt, Berenick, and Newman of Cambridge, Massachusetts, to analyze current programs of instruction on cognitive skills, end quote. For an understanding of what research on human intelligence encompasses, let me quote from the Human Intelligence Newsletter, October 1981. This is what we're talking about, and this is what Jake's talking about. Quote, the search for new referential systems and new values modifying existing beliefs should be based on modern microbiology. A scientific approach should be free from doctrinal bias and its findings applicable to all mankind. Ideological confrontations between East and West, Marxism and liberalism, Arabs and Jews do have economic, historical, and political bases, but no biological basis. These antagonisms have been created by the human brain and could be solved by the wiser brains of future man.
Wow. Quite a statement.
Yeah. I was talking to Jake about that. Jake, why don't you say something yourself there?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a few things that stand out to me here. And so the emphasis here is that education is biological, has nothing to do with the mind, and certainly has nothing to do with the spirit or the soul, which means there's no transcendent morality. So when they talk about free from doctrinal bias, this means free from your religious doctrinal bias, free from the Constitution, free from the Bible, etc. Okay. It's free from ideological confrontations. It's neither capitalist nor communist. It's neither private nor public. It's public-private. It's technocratic. It's communitarian. And so what this basically means is that there is no basis to you challenging the stimulus response. It's just a matter of rewiring those synapses, the neurons in the brain, in a way where you respond reflexively to the curriculum that is given to you by the state for the purpose of workforce planning. And eventually now it's going to be social credit. So it's basically the medicalization of education. And, you know, people that want to put the chip in you, like Ray Kurzweil, chief of engineering at Google, he literally thinks you can go beyond stimulus response on a computer where there still might be some room for the brain to question the stimulus and just download it straight into the brain through Elon Musk's Neuralink. Facebook's got them as well. But the idea here is that there is no essence to you or your soul or your conscience that can actually learn something beyond either Skinner's stimulus response on a computer or just some electronic download, which is basically a lobotomy mm-hmm. of the moral, religious, spiritual part of the brain.
That is a very, very important point of all this, is that every one of these studies are conducted by people who are at the very least atheists, and an awful lot of them are Satanists. And so they see Christianity, they see religion, as Marx said, as the opioid of the public. And so what we need to understand with all this is that religion has no part whatsoever in any of it. Isn't that right?
B.F. Skinner wrote a book called Beyond Freedom and Dignity. Now, I don't know what's beyond freedom and dignity, but I'm pretty sure it's no good, and I don't want anything to do with it, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure it's not better. And so what that really means for him, though, is that the concepts of freedom and dignity, that those are these archaic superstitions, just like God and truth and morality and things like that. And for him, the new system, the new utopia, he had his Walden too, which is his utopist book, will be set up based on just having the proper environment situated. So, you know, there is no moral essence or transcendent nature to truth and reality. It's just responses to stimuli. So if you could set up the perfect technocracy, then people would behave perfectly and you couldn't judge it good or bad. It's just a reflex to the stimulus. And so that is absolutely... you know, I guess you'd call it humanist, but if you remove God from it, it's atheist. And then when you make mm-hmm. man his or her own God, which is literally what people like Ray Kurzweil say, you had Sergey Brin and Larry Page of Google saying they want to be the mind of God. You have a book by Yuval Noah Harari called Homo Deus, and it's all about transhumanism. You have the Way of the Future, Church of Artificial Intelligence. By the way, Way of the Future, WOTF. Mm-hmm. It sounds like a cute little play on WTF, because you know how people that want to be their own gods, just like in the Genesis says, right? That's basically Satan's promise that you could be your own god. They like to use potty, you know, secret little potty words in their inversions of truth. And so... Absolutely. You know, if you talk about beyond freedom and dignity, you're talking about basically technocracy being your own god and, you know, Luciferians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I have to tell you, John, I sure wished I'd have had you for a college professor instead of some of the nitwits that I had, because they were reinforcing all the things that you're talking about that need to be taken out of our education system. Charlotte, I want to give you a few minutes toward the end here. Talk about the deliberate dumbing down of America. Talk about some of the things you've done, and then let's direct them to your website. And we want people to know more about you. And then I want to give John the last word so we can talk about his book, The School World Order, because I've read it and it's a terrific book.
It is a wonderful book. And I want to thank, we're all thanking each other while we're doing this. Won't be allowed to do this in the future. But I want to thank John. He just came out of the blue when, at a time when I felt we'd lost the game, you know, and contacted me. And I very much appreciate the kudos he's given to me. I don't know why. I guess maybe something I said in my books resonated with him. But I think he should get all the credit, because he picked up a mantle that I didn't think was going to exist. And mm-hmm. and he's so young. I can't believe he's that any youngster. That he really is a youngster. Mm-hmm. And how could he have such an incredible brain?
Well, we have these young legacies, Charlotte. Right. We have these young legacies, and certainly he might be your young legacy.
Oh, he is. I mean, I just am so thrilled, and we're going to be meeting finally soon, I think, and we're going to have a lot of fun. We won't just be talking about all this horrible stuff, I hope. And I want to thank you, too. I think everybody knows enough about me. It's all over the internet, you know, just type in. I'm very mouthy, and I've been mouthy for, well, I never was that mouthy when I was growing up. You know, for everybody to know what I wanted to be, we all end mm-hmm. up being what we never dreamed we were going to be. I wanted to be a tennis player. Mm-hmm. Well, that didn't happen.
You've done a lot more for society being what you are, Charlotte. You've done a great deal.
That's true. But, you know, that Margaret, what's her name, from Australia, the mm-hmm. great tennis player. She's another model for all of us. I mean, she's on the same wavelength we're on. Mm-hmm. Poor woman, she must be having a heart attack now with what's going on out there. I have to admit, I'm one quarter Australian. They didn't used to be like that. No, I mean, they drank the poisonous Kool-Aid. So anyway, I just want to wish everybody, there's nothing we can say. None of us know what's going to happen. We have to pray constantly. I have something very funny here. I got to show you on this thing. Look, I just stuck this into my mess of filing. And it's every time I didn't do it on purpose. I come and I look at my desk and it shows up and it says, got it?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And so when I'm really having a fit about everything going on in my life and in everything else and all, I walk up to my desk and there it is. Why worry when you can pray?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because yeah. that's really where it's at.
That's really where it's at. And we're going to be doing that next week in our program next week. But absolutely. Well, Charlotte, I have to thank you very much for being my guest again. It's always a great pleasure. Someday I'm going to get a chance to meet you and visit with you in person. We've had a lot of great conversations over the years.
You're always welcome here. You know, all I have for guests, you know, I have little types of animals and fish in the river. And you mm-hmm. like to fish?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I live in a similar situation in Montana. My nearest neighbor's about 3 miles away, and I can look out my front door at night and I don't see a light anywhere. So.
You know, I think we've been given this by God Almighty to live in environments like this. I'm afraid Jake isn't.
Yeah, well, we'll get him out here. Jake, I want to give you the last minute or so. Please talk about your book, School World Order. And Charlotte, thank you again. It's always such a great pleasure.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And God bless everybody.
Thank you.
Okay, so this we gotta go. So my book is School World Order. You can get it at Trine Day Books. You can check out all the stuff I've written. I write articles pretty frequently. You can get all of that on schoolworldorder.info. If you want to follow my stuff on Twitter, it's Dallas Professor at Professor Dallas. And I guess I could just finish with Charlotte says, you know, she says this a lot. Yeah, she doesn't know why I give her so much credit. Well, because I wouldn't have been able to. All I did was put the pieces together that she had and then just added all the specific stuff I saw on the ground level as a teacher. And on top of that, she's always been responsive. She reached out to me and I was trying to find her email to send her the article because I thought I did a good job building on her research. And then for whatever reason, I couldn't find it. It wasn't a good end. She sent me an email and I was like, this has got to be a virus or spam or somebody's trolling me. And it was her. And she just basically said, you're right on. And she was going through some really serious stuff with her son. And it didn't mm-hmm. matter how hot it got in that situation. She wrote the foreword to the book. She was always there to help me with research. So even though she didn't realize it, she was always there for me in a lot more ways than, you know, I try to bring this stuff up with the people on the ground level that I work with and teach with. And you know, it's way over their head. So, I mean, I felt so isolated when she told me I was on the right track. That was
that gave me the endurance to get where we are now. So thank you, Charlotte.
Well,
and, yeah, thanks, Dan, for having me on.
Well, you're quite welcome. I look forward to the next time. And I want to thank our listeners for joining us, because this has been a real eye-opener. It's really helped a lot of people to connect the dots. Thank you both again for being my guests. Looks like Patrick Howley is ready to start the campaign show. And Patrick, you've been watching the last half hour or so of our program. I think you probably have a great respect for these two people. Yeah, he's on mute. Okay, well, Patrick, we'll turn it over to you and the campaign show. And thank you all for joining us. John, we'll be talking. I absolutely love what you're saying here. You're an incredibly bright man. I really do wish I had you for a college professor and instead of some of the nitwits that I had. So thank you.
I appreciate that much, sir, and I can't wait to talk again.
All righty. Thank you both.